So I want to thank you, first of all, for giving me the opportunity to be here this morning and to talk to you all and to experience God's grace and love through a different set of people than I normally do. And I have to say that as much as I love all the blonde wood and contemporary design of the sanctuary of Urbandale United Church of Christ, I love this space as well, because there's something about the dark wood and the stained glass and the brick that just sort of screams the eternal nature of God and the eternal aspects of our faith and our journeys as God's people. And so this is a good space for me. I like it. It resonates with my spirit, just in terms of making all of that seem like it's always been there. And there's something comforting about that. And you've done a marvelous job of incorporating modern technology into the space without sacrificing the architectural integrity of the space and the ambiance that so carries worship forward for you. I am not a person who uses technology a lot. I mean, I can wear a microphone and I can use a cell phone, and I can make all of those things work for me most of the time. But it's hard. It's kind of an effort for me. And I've decided that surfing the internet is probably not something I ought to engage in very often, because I start out with the best of intentions. I make a little list of things that I want to do online and go to these sites, but invariably I end up watching video clips of kittens and puppies. And I know that the things I click on when I'm doing that tell somebody somewhere something about me. And that's kind of unnerving and unsettling, that somebody's keeping track of all that stuff. And it may not, I don't think Cambridge Analytics is all that interested in me, but maybe they are. I mean, you know, it's the aggregate that they want, and I'm part of that. I'm part of that aggregate, and it's aggravating to be part of that. And I know that every once in a while I get a pop-up on my screen, and it's something ridiculous. And I think, why on earth do they think that I would be interested in that? In that ad for something that I'm not going to buy, but I clicked on something somewhere, or I responded to something in a certain way, and they know that now, and so I'm going to get those things. And about a year ago, maybe longer, I started getting routinely things on my screen about leasing a Learjet. And I thought, okay, what did I click on? What did I do that made them think that I would be in the market for a Learjet? And I've racked my brains. I really have. I'm trying to think, okay, and I don't even know what qualifies one to lease a Learjet. I mean, what kind of credit rating do you have to lease a Learjet? I mean, my credit rating isn't bad, but it's not that good. I mean, I get nervous when I put a dent in a rental car. I can't imagine wrecking a Learjet. I mean, that would haunt me I guess I wouldn't have to worry about the rest of my life if I wrecked a Learjet. But now, what I see on my screen every once in a while is that little line that says add choices. You ever see that? Does that come up for you too? We get to pick now which ads will pop up, or at least categories of ads. Things that we might be interested in. And at first I thought, well, that's kind of nice. I mean, I don't have to look at ads that I'm not interested in. Maybe I can get rid of those Learjet invitations. But then I think to myself, no, they're not being nice to me. They're focusing their advertising, and they don't want to waste their money, so they're giving me some choices. But I wonder what kind of choice that really is. Is it a choice that suits my needs, or is it a choice that suits their needs? And is it really a choice at all? I have a member of my congregation whose day job is to work for a company that installs electrical systems in new construction. So things like security systems and HVAC controls, anything that has to string wires from one place to another, that's what they do. And so he told me not long ago that they frequently install thermostats that aren't connected to anything. They don't control a thing. But if you got a room full of people, and some think it's too hot and some think it's too cold, it's helpful to have a thermostat they can go to and adjust so they feel better. Right? Got nothing to do with the HVAC system at all, but it makes the people in the room feel better. Now, is that a choice? Not really. They haven't chosen to do anything but to respond to the fact that they see a thermostat on the wall and there's something about the climate in the room that they don't like. And sometimes I think that's true, that our choices are an illusion of sorts. That they're designed not so much to make us agents of what happens next, but they're designed to pacify or mollify or maybe just make us go away. And in my more cynical moments, I think about our political system and I think, you know, maybe our democracy is only that, giving us the illusion of choice in the world so that we don't get our torches and pitchforks and march on whoever's in control of what's going on. I remember when the primaries were over in the 2016 election cycle, and I remember hearing a statistic that kind of disturbed me. It was that the majority of people in both parties were unhappy with their candidate. And I thought to myself, how did we end up with a system that generates candidates that the majority of people in their own party don't like? There's something fundamentally wrong with that. So do we have a choice in this or not? That's the question that I think is disturbing. Because we all like to think we have some agency. We like to think we have some freedom. And there are folks in the world who say, no, actually, we don't. That we are the product of genetics and environment. And that really all of the choices that we make are predetermined by that. And that if we could just figure out all of that stuff to the nth degree, we would be able to predict all the choices that anyone makes. And that's what all those logarithms and algorithms that function in behind the scenes in websites and in how we work, that's how that all goes together. Somebody's trying to figure out what choice we're going to make next and make money or profit in some other way by our choices. In today's gospel reading, we have that line. Jesus says to his disciples, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." And for us, that's probably a little hard to hear, because after all, we value our freedom of religion. And we choose, don't we? We choose what church to go to. We choose what to believe. We choose which version of the Bible to read. We choose which minister will preach the gospel to us on Sunday morning. Except you didn't choose me, you got stuck with me. So that's kind of an aberration from the system. But we like to have that choice. And yet, when I think about my faith journey and the church I grew up in, you know, there was a time when I sort of rebelled. And as a teenager, you know, I looked around the sanctuary on a Sunday morning, and by golly, I could find a lot of hypocrisy if I looked for it. I could think about the people around me and how they behaved during the week, and I could say to myself, well, they're not really very good Christians because of what they do during the week. And so I got dissatisfied with the church pretty fast. And part of my understanding of my call was to sort of be the loyal opposition. And I wasn't too loyal, so that was probably a stretch. I wanted to make things different. I wanted it to be the way I wanted it to be. And my choice was to take my career and make it to be this, what I'm doing today. But then I read these words, "You did not choose me, but I chose you." And I have to confess to you all that there was a huge element of God's choosing and how my life unfolded. I thought I picked the schools I went to. Maybe, maybe not. It's kind of hard to say. When my mom and dad were nearing retirement, my mother decided to take part in a program offered by the Iowa Conference of the United Church of Christ called Center Learn, and she became a licensed lay pastor. And she served the church in Rossi, Iowa, which has since closed. And I thought, you know, yay for mom. I think she wanted to do this all of her life. But being raised in the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, which did not even consider the possibility of ordaining women, it was not a choice for her. It wasn't open to her. And then a disturbing thought occurred to me. What if I was living out her frustrated call to ministry? Yikes! Yikes! Did I choose that? Or did somehow my mother's calling get funneled through me? Family systems are kind of strange that way, right? We sometimes live out the hopes and dreams of our parents or other relatives. Did I choose it, or was it chosen for me? But if we keep reading and we discover that Jesus is saying more than, I chose you, I told you, I instructed you, or commanded you. Because the word for commandment or command in this passage is a word that in Greek is probably not so much the way we understand commandments as rules and laws and somebody dictating to you what you have to do. It's probably better understood as being aware of the end goal and final purpose, of understanding what it is to work together with someone for the same goal. So if we read that in that way, it becomes something more like, now, I am going to give you a commandment. But not just a commandment, but knowledge of the end goal. And that makes it more, it flows better, right? I mean, I've always thought that when John writes the gospel, John uses stuff that doesn't necessarily go together. We start with commandments, and all of a sudden Jesus is talking about, I no longer call you servants, but I call you friends. He does that, I think, because friends know what their friends want. They understand their deepest yearnings and goals, and they understand how to move them toward that, to get them unstuck. How many times have you sat down with a friend to talk through something because you know that that friend is going to help you figure it out? Because they know you. They know what you want. They know what your goals in life are. They know the most important things in your life and how they fit together. And they can call you on it when you start imagining things that aren't there. It's the difference between knowing what the immediate task is and how to do it and understanding what the end goal and purpose is. The difference between knowing today we're going to move the library from this room to this room and knowing that when we get all this work done, this is what we're going to be able to do. This is how we can use the space. This is how our mission and ministry will be enhanced by a new configuration of space and utilization of it. To understand what the ultimate goal really is. That's what this passage is about. Jesus isn't imparting to his followers new rules and new regulations. Jesus is reminding them that because they have heard his words and been with him in his ministry, they know what the end game is. They know what the strategy is. They know where it's all supposed to end up and how it's all supposed to turn out. And Jesus says to them, the love I have for you, you have to now have for each other. And that is the end game, that you love one another. sometimes in the life of the church and in other places, we get all philosophical about ends and means. And sometimes we say, you know, the means are not justified by the ends. And I think what Jesus is saying here to the disciples is, the means are the ends. The means are the ends. This is the goal. That somehow we construct a community, that we live together in such harmony and love, that will be the thing that God wants. We can get caught up in policies and procedures and laws and rules and all of those things, but in this passage at least, Jesus isn't concerned with that. He's not. Jesus is concerned that his disciples will live out their calling. Their calling. The fact that they were chosen to do this work. I don't know if any of you have seen the movie The Blind Side. It's about a football player, Michael Orr, who began life in a rough way. He lived in the projects, as a lot of African Americans in that part of our country did. And he's adopted by a lily white, affluent family in the suburbs. And so much of the movie is about the contention between these two different ways of living. But Michael is a pretty good football player. In fact, he's an extraordinary football player. And so he gets a lot of offers from a lot of schools. And he finally picks Ole Miss, which is the school that his adoptive parents went to. And the NCAA raises some eyebrows because they wonder about these boosters from a school who've adopted a kid who's a really good football player, and now guess what? That kid's going to go to the school that they support. And so the NCAA wants to make sure that Michael had the choice. He had the choice. And so they're asking all kinds of questions about what his parents did and said and what his tutors told him as they were getting him the grades he needed to qualify for this scholarship. And that all of the things he got, the car, the clothes, the bedroom, the nice home to live in, weren't just bribes. And finally, Michael, the actor playing Michael, turns to the NCAA official who's asking him all these questions and says, How come you never asked me what I wanted? And so the interviewer says, okay, why are you going to Ole Miss? And he said, because that's where my family goes. They've always gone there. They always will. It's a poignant moment in the movie. Because we realize at that point that all the conflict that has gone on before, all the stuff that really highlighted how much he didn't belong in their world and how much their world didn't meet his needs and how much anxiety and angst went into their trying to hold this weird family together, it didn't matter. Because of the relationship that they had with each other. They cared deeply for each other, and they all wanted what was best for Michael, and Michael wanted what was best for his family. And sometimes we lose sight of the fact that this message that Jesus gives is deeply relational, deeply relational. We get hung up on the rules and the commandments, and we forget how intimate this is. I have a colleague who knows a whole lot more about Greek than I do. And he has kind of done his own translation of this that has to do with all of the elements of this translation issue that I've highlighted about the difference between commandment and end goals. And he likes to use the phrase end goals and deepest purposes. And so I'm going to read the passage again as he has translated it. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Live continuously in my love. If you keep my end goals and deepest purposes in mind, you will live continuously in my love. And just as I have kept my Father's deepest purposes and live continuously in that love, that's how you will live. I have said these things to you so that my joy may be in you and that your joy may be complete. And this is my end goal and deepest purpose, that you ache with care over one another, as I have ached with care for you. No one has greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. You are my friends if you do my end goals and deepest purposes. I do not call you servants any longer, because the servant does not know what the master is doing, but I have called you friends because I have made known to you everything that I have heard from my Father. You did not choose me, but I chose you, and I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last, so that the Father will give you whatever you ask in my name. I'm giving you these end goals and deepest purposes so that you may ache with care for one another. We all have pop-ups in our lives. Those things that suddenly appear that we did not expect, couldn't anticipate, and probably don't know how to deal with. They happen in everyone's life. And we are tempted sometimes to think that somehow this was being imposed on us for some kind of purpose, and we usually assign the agency for that to a divine purpose or presence or some kind of evil presence or purpose in our lives. And it's either a challenge or hurdle that we somehow have to overcome, or maybe it's a blessing that we didn't expect and got to somehow celebrate. But those things that pop up, they are opportunities for us to remember that we are chosen. We are chosen. Not because we're special, not because we're better than other people, but because we have been made aware of this end goal and purpose. It is for us the way we bear fruit in the world, the fruit that will last, the kind of thing that nobody can ever take away. We have to remember how it is that we interact with each other so that the love of God can be transferred to the relationships we have in this time and place. At one point in the movie, the Blind Side movie, the family's deciding what they're going to do about this kid, this homeless kid. How are we going to live with ourselves if we don't do something? It starts out small, just a place to sleep for the night. And eventually they decide that, no, he's going to be part of the family. They take him in. But more than that, they allow his gifts, his purposes, his fears and anxieties to be theirs. That's the challenge, I think. That the things that pop up in our lives remind us that we are not just servants who blindly do what we're told, but we've been promoted. We are now friends, because friends know what the other wants. Friends understand what the end purpose is. Friends know the grand design that the architect is trying to accomplish. And in all those things, we have the knowledge that God expects us to love one another. Amen.